Since it first opened on Broadway in the fall of 1964, Fiddler on the Roof has rarely not been on the stage somewhere, and that includes schools, army bases, and countries from Argentina to Japan. Now, award-winning journalist Barbara Eisenberg weaves together behind-the-scenes tales and anecdotes on the making of the show and film with thoughts on its cultural importance and resonance for such an enormous and diverse audience. This is just in time for the opening of the new Broadway production of Fiddler on the Roof, which plays at the Broadway Theater and opens on the 20th. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Barbara Eisenberg to the program. Barbara, thank you very much for being with us.
It is my pleasure.
Great pleasure to have you. The name of the book, Tradition, the highly improbable, ultimately triumphant Broadway to Hollywood story of Fiddler on the Roof, the world's most beloved musical. As I mentioned in the introduction, it's hard to find a time and a place where this show is not playing. It will reopen on Broadway in just a matter of days. It's already playing previews. What is it about the show that is so timeless?
Well, because the story is timeless. It's about tradition. It's about repression. It's about prejudice, diaspora. And this is something which appeals to people pretty much any time and anywhere. You know, then there's this great book, a well-crafted book by Joseph Stein. These songs, you know. One person in the interview told me that once you get those songs in your head, you're going to live with them till you die. And I have to say that when I was writing this book, those songs kept going through my head. And they have. They still do. Especially Tradition, every time I pick up my book. And
One of the things that you bring out in the book, which I find fascinating, is as the show was being developed, as it was being written, that idea of tradition kind of evolved. That wasn't really on the page originally.
Oh, yes. That's very true. You know, originally, the three writers, Joseph Stein, who did the book, and Sheldon Harnick, who did the lyrics, and Jerry Bach, who did the music, they thought this is their next assignment, really. You know, they didn't actually think that they were going to write a show that would last all this time. They approached it with the idea of just doing something they felt passionate about. And so they did a small show. Now, originally, the show opened with a song called We Haven't Missed a Sabbath Yet.
Right.
And it was set in the kitchen. It was about making challah, plucking chickens, stuff like that. But when Jerome Robbins came in to direct the show, he said, what's this show about? And, you know, everybody, the three principals would say, well, it's about, you know, a Jewish family, a guy with five daughters. And Robbins would say, it is not what it is about. No, that is not. It is not a big enough story. And he kept asking over and over. And one day, Sheldon Harnick said, it's about tradition. And Jerome Robbins said, that's it. Write that.
The first three words in the subtitle are the highly improbable. What made the show so improbable?
Well, part of it was when they started showing it to producers, the producers thought it would be limited to a Jewish audience. The producers didn't see the larger picture, the producers for Broadway. And I remember that one producer said, you know, what are we going to do when we run out of Hadassah groups that want to see it? You know, it's amazing now when we think about it. And I think they didn't see it in a large way. And, you know, it was the same problem with the film. When Marish first took the idea of a film to everyone at the company, they United Artists, they didn't see it either. They said, this is a local story.
Right.
They want international audiences.
You do talk in the book about Jerome Robbins, and I do want to bounce back to that for a moment, because in the book you basically call him the fourth author, because he had such input into the show.
He definitely was the fourth author. You know, and for me, I mean, one of the best things about writing the book was sitting in a room at the New York Public Library and reading through all of Robbins' notes about the show. So far as I know, Robbins never threw out a piece of paper. And you could see him trying to figure out. And the main thing that Robbins kept asking was why? Why are we telling a story? Why does it matter? And, you know, there's a director named Glenn Casale, who's in California, who's directed the show 15 times now. And he said the first thing he does when he gets his actors together is he tells them, go home, look at what's happening in Syria. You know, look what's happening everywhere else. People are losing their homes.
Right.
So it keeps coming back. There's always a hook to do Fiddler.
Yes, in fact, when I saw the new production last week, there were two or three lines that were so relevant to what is happening, as you mentioned, in Syria, that I actually went back to the original text to see if they were in it, because I thought they were added, and indeed they were there.
Oh yeah, an eye for an eye. I think it's something Tevye says in there. Oh yes, let's make it an eye for an eye, then we'll all be blind.
Right.
You know, I mean, stuff like that. It sounds like someone could have said it a week ago.
Let us talk about the character of Tevye. Of course, the open on Broadway with Zero Mostel. Let us just say, to sum up many pages that you write in the book, Zero Mostel, perhaps not the easiest guy to work with.
That is true. Zero Mostel was this brilliant man. You know, unfortunately, he died before I was involved with this book, and I didn't get to talk to him. But I talked to many, many people who worked with him and who lived, you know, a cousin who talked about him. One of my favorite stories, when he did his Milkman song, you know, If I Were a Rich Man.
I'd build a big, tall house with rooms by the dozen right in the middle of the town. A fine tin roof with a real wooden floors below. There could be one long staircase just going up, and one even longer coming down, and one more leading nowhere just for show.
Supposed to reach into the milk can and pull out a wet rag, you know. And so he used to take that wet rag, go to the edge of the stage, and wring it out over the orchestra. And one of the musicians told me when they saw him coming toward the edge of the stage, they would all grab their music and put it on so it wouldn't get all wet. You know, he just did whatever he felt like. He would talk to people in the second row. Mrs. Feinstein, are we having a good time tonight? I mean, in the middle of the show.
And this obviously did not go over well with the producers, with the writers of the show, not to mention the orchestra that was getting soaked.
I know.
And that was stopped because one night they figured out, oh, we just won't put water in the bucket anymore.
Right, right. I remember Sheldon telling me about that. And so, and Zero Mostel puts his hand in, you know, to dip the rag in, and it comes up, and he doesn't know what to do. I'm sure he made some clever line that Harnick didn't tell me.
When it comes to something like that, though, it's a double-edged sword, isn't it? Because it's that Zero Mostel personality that is bringing many people in, and yet it is also going against what they want the show to be.
Right. And, you know, apparently Zero Mostel thought he was the reason for the success of the show. And according to the authors and a few other people I spoke with, when Zero left the show and all the other parade of Broadway Tevyes came in, the show's revenue did not drop that much. And it lasted, you know, for 7 years. And he was only almost 8 years. And Zero Mostel was only in it for a year, although he came back and played in it again briefly.
Fiddler won 9 Tony Awards for Best Musical, for Jerome Robbins' direction, for the choreography, for performances by Zero Mostel, and also, of course, for Stein, Harnick, and Bach, as well as other awards. When it came time for Mostel to get his award, you write, as Best Actor in a Musical, he stood at the podium and said, "Since no one else has thanked me, I will thank me."
Well, that says it all, doesn't it?
It really does.
Yeah.
And were there bad feelings amongst the cast?
Well, I think that people liked him, basically, you know, as a person. But he was just so difficult to deal with, and that they didn't have as much control. You know, I heard that sometimes he would be on stage, and if he weren't performing, he would face the other cast members and make faces. You know, one time
right.
when he was doing a toy production, he pulled the pajamas off of his wife in the show, and she found it funny. She was a comedian as well as an actress. But I don't imagine a lot of people would have found it funny. You know, there are a lot of people who are really, really talented who are difficult to work with. And sometimes, the balance is even and sometimes the balance isn't. But he was such a talent.
It became quite obvious when the film came around that it would not be Zero Mostel. And they cast Topol, who was someone who had not played the role on Broadway, correct?
That's right. And Norman Jewison, who did the film, said that casting that part of Tevye was the most difficult thing he did. And he did meet with Vera Mostel, but Jewison felt that Mostel was too big for the screen because he's in practically every scene. And then he also was to New York. He wasn't the Russian that Jewison saw in his head. And he was besieged by actors and agents by people who wanted that role. And my favorite story is he had gone over to see Danny Kaye because Danny Kaye was a friend of Jewison's and wanted that part more than anything in the world. And he really wanted to love Danny Kaye, who was one of many prominent people who was interested. And he left Danny Kaye, and Danny Kaye kept telling him, look, I'm Jewish, you know, I have a Zadie and all this, so I really want to do this. Jewison went back to his office, and he said, you know, he's too red-haired, too professional, too light on his feet to be Tevye. Then he gets a call from his agent, and Jewison swears it happened the same day. His agent said, how do you feel about driving to Palm Springs? And Jewison said, why? And the agent said, well, you know, Frank Sinatra wants to talk to you about this show. And Jewison said he wouldn't go. And the agent said, you're turning down Frank Sinatra? And then Jewison said it was so hard. He didn't know what to do. And just then, or not just then, that's probably a few days later, Joe Stein and he were talking, and Stein told him about Topol, who was then playing Tevye in the London production of Fiddler on the Roof for one more week. And Jewison got on a plane, went to see him, went backstage, said, you're my Tevye. And Topol told me he didn't believe him. You know, he thought, oh, everybody in the world wants this. He's not going to choose me.
Right. So. There have been so many revivals as the revival that opens this week. This is really proof that this is a show that always demands its time and really is a show that probably should come back every few years, shouldn't it?
Well, you know, it does come back. It comes back probably while we are speaking. There are hundreds of productions of it all over the country going on in high schools, in temples and churches, a few community centers, because there are many good parts for kids, for teenagers, for adults. So it's only a matter of time till the sixth revival comes.
And when you see a revival open up, and you, and I know you haven't seen the show yet, but Danny Burstein and Jessica Hecht playing Tevye and Golda, it seems on paper like that sounds just great, and then when I saw it, it is great. And I assume you had a similar reaction. That looks good on paper of those two. As I said, I know you haven't seen the performance yet, but
oh yes, I do. I mean, I have not seen the performances yet, but I do know all the people who are performing, and I've seen Danny Burstein on stage many a time. Jessica Hecht, I've always admired. I haven't heard her sing. But I have heard Danny Burstein sing, you know, in Cabaret and South Pacific.
Yes.
You know, he has, and I've watched, you know, people can watch these things on YouTube. You know, you can watch the dress rehearsal, things like that, little snippets of it.
They look great.
And that looked good.
Yeah. It's quite a production and an awful lot of fun. And it seems that whenever they restage it, it does very well at the box office as well.
I think it does.
When all is said and done, as you look at the worldwide cultural phenomenon, because that's another part of this, that it's not just in this country, that it is a worldwide phenomenon, what do you think the takeaway from the book is? And our takeaway about this production and the show?
Well, I'm going to tell you a story about Japan. I think that might be the way to explain it.
Okay.
When Joseph Stein went to Japan for the very first Asian production of the show, at the intermission of this very first show, in Asia, he was talking with the Japanese producer. And the producer, Japanese producer, said, "I don't understand this." He said, how do they relate to this in America? And Joe Stein said, "What do you mean?" He said, "It's so Japanese."
And that's when you learn that it's universal.
That's right. That's when Joe Stein learned it was universal.
Well, the name of the new book is Tradition, the highly improbable, ultimately triumphant Broadway to Hollywood story of Fiddle Around the Roof, the world's most beloved musical. The book is now out in paperback from St. Martin's Press. It's even available at the merch stands at the Broadway show, so you can see it there as well. Barbara, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Great pleasure. Again, it's Tradition by Barbara Eisenberg, published by St. Martin's. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.